Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Rose City Politics. It is November the 10th. Our regular panel tonight includes myself, John Lidke. We have Doug Sartori as well. Doug, how you doing?
Really well. Ready for an exciting night of data and statistics.
Yeah, this is right up your alley. We don't even have Don here tonight to make fun of you for it at all. I'm going to be like the lonesome person trying to pop off some jokes here or there. It's not going to work. Disappointing. We also, though, have on the show tonight, guest with us, Justin Falcon, our CEO of Workforce Windsor Essex. How are you doing tonight?
I'm great, John. Thanks for the invitation to be on the show today.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we really want to dive into these StatsCan numbers and who else we want to go to when we're talking about employment figures, other than maybe Fraser Fathers, local researcher. That was pretty good. How was that segue? How you doing, Fraser?
It was a great segue. Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we love to have you here. You are, you know, you're well past the five in the club time. You're getting closer to 10 times on. You're just going to have to be a full-time panelist moving forward. I'm just going to start calling it in.
So that's way too many podcasts for me.
Yeah, well, deal with it, man. Three's the charm, right? If you're listening tonight and you are not a Patreon subscriber, head over to patreon.com/RoseCityPolitics. And we would appreciate that very much. We are also in BizX Magazine and BizXMagazine.com. We have just seen that our November-December issue has dropped. We're talking about Festival Plaza, and we opined on Festival Plaza before motions were put in place to change up things. So, you know, hold that in your head while you're reading our pieces. Our opinions may have varied just a little bit, but we're also on all your favorite social media and podcasting apps. And Rose City Politics has been able to broadcast live on tape throughout this entire pandemic and before it, thanks to the kind support of Luna 625, Building Better Communities. We have no time here, so we will jump right into this. I said at the top of the show, we will be talking about Statistics Canada. The Labor Force Survey has come out for the Windsor CMA. Workforce Windsor Essex has put together a very nice package that goes through some of the highlights of it and breaks down the numbers. For those of you who aren't aware, I don't know why you'd be listening to this podcast if you don't know, but the Windsor CMA does include Lakeshore, Tecumseh, Windsor, LaSalle, and Amherstburg. So some results at a glance that we want to look at. Population, 305,800, up 200 from last month. Labor force, 185,900, up 1,200 from the previous month. Not participation rate, 119,900. That's down 1,000 from the previous month. Employment, 168,800, up 3,400 from last month. And unemployment, 17,100, down 2,200 from previous month. So just, you know, right off the bat, I'm going to bring your voice in here, Justin. Just, you know, I can go through all these numbers myself, but no one wants to hear me just droning going through these numbers. What do you see here? What stands out right off the top?
Yeah, thanks, John. I think, it's important to recognize that these are estimates and that they, for the most part, include sort of the more urban areas of the region. So they're not very good at illustrating sort of the employment or unemployment situation that may or may not be happening in Kingsville and sort of Leamington and some of the other sort of more rural-ish areas in the county. But in terms of what is expected in these reports, I think there are a lot of good signs in here, right? You know, one number in particular is that there were 3,400 more people that were estimated to be employed last month. And I think that's a real coup. Typically this is the number that, you know, politicians and others will tend to tout when talking about sort of job creation and sort of growth. So in the Windsor CMA, this was a good number for us. It's not normally high like this. And so I think that was a good sign. The other number here is 2,200 less people unemployed. And you're now saying, well, that doesn't equal one another. And that's not always the case, because sometimes people move from not looking, not working, to all of a sudden working. And so that's what's happening in these numbers. People are coming in off the sidelines and sort of re-entering the workforce, perhaps for the first time in a while. But overall, I think these are good numbers. We're of course still the highest unemployment in Canada, so that's to be noted. but that's not entirely abnormal. Windsor tends to be sort of one of the more stubborn labor forces in Canada and even in Ontario. And more often than not across, say, for example, Canada, when I've looked back and done the research, you know, we've typically been the worst, you know, almost one out of every 3 or 4 months. So we do not have a good sort of track record in this particular case, but we are on the right side of the momentum in this particular case.
Fraser, I'll let you comment on it. You know, what are you seeing off the bat?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Justin said. I think the other thing to look at in these numbers is not necessarily the month-to-month number, but that trend. You know, the survey itself that it comes from has some noise where, you know, they rotate their sample by about a third every month. And when a new portion of that sample comes in, if they just get a wonky sample sometimes, it can like lead to, you know, a 1 or 2% jump. But I think it's about looking at almost seasonally, you know, like, okay, what happened in the spring? What happened in the summer? What happened in the fall? You know, those sort of things. And are you sort of trending in a consistent way up or down? You know, I agree with Justin. And the image behind me is actually the Southwestern Ontario CMA's and their unemployment rates going back to 2014. And so you can sort of see if you squint, you know, closely at your YouTube video, how Windsor sort of tracked in there. You can see where the pandemic happened, the big spike there back in March of 2020. And then, you know, how things have recovered or not necessarily recovered in certain parts. And, you know, one of those outlier data points is actually just sort of right here, and it's Guelph. Back in 2018, where their unemployment rate was 1.8%, which is like an unheard of number. And it was down there for about 3 months. So a lot of people think, oh, that was just a wonky sample that got into the labor force survey for Guelph. But, you know, they still, and consistently though, Guelph has always been one of the lowest unemployment rates in Ontario. So despite that really low number, it's a, you know, employment wise, it's a very strong community.
So I wanted to ask, and I'll start with you, Justin, the CMA unemployment rate in Windsor is higher than Ontario and Canada. And as you mentioned previously, that's persistent. That's been a persistent pattern here. So I like your optimism, and I think there is cause for optimism in these numbers, but we also know that the second shift at the Windsor Assembly Plant will be ending in the spring for at least a little while. And given that we are in a place where our unemployment is persistently higher, do you think that there are things that we need to see or changes that need to happen in the short term to avoid the risk of higher unemployment?
Yeah, great question, Doug. I think the thing, and Fraser touched on it, the numbers are sort of 3 month sample sizes, more or less. And so big changes in employment or unemployment tend to be muted or sort of rounded a little bit. So they're not fully seen as sort of sharp spikes one way or the other. And so you saw that in sort of, even though that the COVID spike is pretty dramatic behind Fraser in the background there, it would have actually been a lot more obscene in actuality. And it would have been a lot higher had it not been a 3 month sample size. But I think to your point about Stellantis, so Stellantis has, you know, prior to sort of this last month had not actually been sort of working for the most part of the year. So the unemployment rates that we've been experiencing for the better part of this year is actually sort of in a weird sort of way representative of sort of the unemployment that you would expect we would probably have, you know, later in the year when another shift, unfortunately, is sidelined and lost. So, you know, that particular event is going to be significant for Windsor. And it's really unfortunate for the workers and everyone who's going to be losing their work. These numbers, you know, at the end of the day, they represent people. And so no amount of sort of sympathy or sort of quick talk about numbers is ever going to do that justice. But I do think there are some good reasons for optimism, Doug. Last month, we had tracked 7,171 job postings in the month, which is up 65% from last October. And basically, a 2.5-3 year high. It's never been this high in all the years or months we've been collecting our own job posting data. So I think, you know, they may not be jobs that are of equal caliber or pay as Stellantis. So let me be clear. They may not, you know, we may not be replacing 1,800 of those jobs at the same rate of pay, but there are some really positive signs. We saw the job postings for electrical and electronics engineers go from 45 to 97, for example, 1 month over the next. So there are some good outliers that we'll have to keep an eye on, see where that goes and how that trends.
Okay, I want to go to Fraser on that, and there's some really interesting stuff in there. But first, I just want to ask, your answer got me thinking, the impact of the supply chain problems across the world on Stellantis, that has, as you said, impacted the employment numbers. To your knowledge, is that impacting other manufacturers in the city, and is that a factor in our unemployment figures?
Yes, I would agree that anytime, you know, Stellantis is not working, that it's impacting others. I think looking back a decade ago, it would have been much more dramatic. And I think there's been some good efforts by manufacturing to diversify their products and to sort of get into other sectors so they're not feeling so weighted by some of these downturns. But by and large, you know, some of these other companies may not have been operating at 100% capacity as a result of Stellantis being sort of laid off for the majority of the year, let's be honest.
Okay, Fraser, I want to give you a chance to respond to anything you heard in Justin's comments that interests you, but I also want you to address the kind of the base question here, which is what drives, or what in your view drives the persistently higher unemployment in Windsor, and what can be done to change it?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. I agree with Justin, you know, the shutdown at Stellantis is sort of baked into these numbers here, and they're sort of, and so it is sort of playing out what we would, you know, you won't see that big spike next April probably right away. And hope, because we don't know exactly where all those workers are going to go when they're unfortunately, you know, that layoff does happen, and hopefully they're brought back quickly. I think for me, I think it's about sort of a long-term trend. And when I think about, you know, unemployment here in Windsor, I think about sort of the labor force participation rate as something that was talked about a lot before the pandemic. You know, there's Workforce Windsor Essex did a report on it back before the pandemic there. We were talking about the participation rate for women. You know, I went back and checked the participation rate. It's not this chart, but I have another chart for Southwestern Ontario. And there's 84 months tracked on this chart. And Doug, I want to quickly ask you, or anyone can ask, how many months do you think Windsor had a participation rate above the average of the seven cities on this chart? Out of 84 months.
Zero. I'm going to say zero.
Yeah. So it's like we, just as a labor force ourselves, we have this gap that's baked into our labor force. And so that's almost what I would almost call a chronic issue that requires big structural sort of exploration on how to fix. You know, we know, some of the work that I've done previously at United Way, we were talking about educational attainment rates. We have lower than average educational attainment rates. We have about a 6% higher rate of just high school being the top level of education compared to provincial averages. And so when you're thinking about what jobs are in demand, you know, the electrical engineer job that Justin just sort of cited, you know, unfortunately, certain people aren't able to get into that field because they don't have the credentials. And that's a structural piece where, like, you know, we got to start not talking about university and college. We got to be talking about like what kids are going into in high school and what are they being exposed to in grade 6 and grade 7 and stuff like that in order to fix those problems. And it'll take a decade or more to play out because you got to hope that the child or young person gets exposed to those things and then goes into that field. I think the other thing that in my mind that comes to mind is income. So Windsor has the lowest living wage in Ontario. And yes, part of that is calculated based on just the cost of living, but there's a sticker shock sort of thing attached to that. And so, you know, we know there are lots of great paying jobs in our community, but we also know that there's a number of jobs that don't pay quite as well. And so there's a linkage, I'm going to bet, between that participation rate of, you know, lower than average participation rate and having a lower than average income, you know, in our community. The challenge then becomes, you know, are we incentivizing people to get back into the labor force when, you know, when they may be out for whatever reason that that may be? Maybe it's a stay-at-home mom, or maybe it's, you know, whatever the reason is. And so, you know, when you think about, you know, we have that low living wage. Yes, there's a cost savings for being in Windsor, but to a degree, Windsor is a low wage jurisdiction. And when you're a low wage jurisdiction, you know, that carries some challenges with it.
Thanks. Thanks for that perspective. You know, you look, I'm sure I'm not the only one who's noticed this. You, wherever you go right now to try to get something done, there's delays. I mean, I tried to get a haircut a while ago and it was a 3 to 4 month wait. I have friends who work in the construction field and they are backlogged. I mean, virtually the only thing right now that isn't a delay, because of, you know, pent up demand right now, although I guess arguably you could say it is automotive, but that's just because you can't get those microchips themselves. Right. So the issue is we've got these high numbers of unemployment. We've got this high type of demand, and we've heard Rakesh Naidu from the Chamber in the Windsor Star piece saying that there's lots of jobs unfilled. So, you know, was this reflected in any of this data that, you know, you guys have gone through? I'll ask you first, Justin, and then go to Fraser. And then I guess the follow-up to that is, you know, how do you reconcile the high demand with, you know, this high unemployment rate? What more needs to be done? Fraser, you were just touching on that, but I'll bring you in first, Justin.
Yeah, you know, it's a extremely sort of complicated issue. A part of it is that, you know, there's been a bit of a K-shaped recovery, I guess is the way you explain it, where sort of one segment of the population has been severely impacted negatively by COVID, and the other part has probably been better off having gone through it in some ways, in terms of being able to save money or not spend money in ways that they maybe previously had been used to sort of their own spending patterns and habits. So they can't go on vacations. Childcare was closed for a number of months, so they weren't paying childcare, you know, and they were, you know, for some parents who were double income and sort of working from home and trying to do schooling from home with their kids, but they weren't spending money. They weren't going places. They weren't going out for movies or going out for dinner. There were a number of behavioral things that really changed the way people spend money. And so, you know, I feel like now, on the sort of as we emerge as part of the exit plan by the premier or the roadmap, there is a group of the population that are ready to spend money. They're ready to go on vacation. They're ready to get in line. They're itching to get a haircut. They're willing to pay a little bit extra for the wood to build the deck, you know. And you know what? Business, in my opinion, it's some of it's supply chain for sure, but another perspective is that, you know, if they can sell their kitchen cabinets for more, they're going to sell their kitchen cabinets for more, you know, because people are going to say, I would like it sooner and I'm willing to pay a bit more. So I think I just read or watched a video on travel. Like, you know, it's insane what the prices people are willing to pay right now just because they haven't been able to travel for so long. So I would say, you know, you may want to hold out if you want to find a better bargain on some of these things for a little bit longer. And if you're willing to hold out, you may get a better price in the long run. But those who are desperate to go somewhere, build something or buy something tomorrow, they're potentially paying more than they ought to have paid. So that's sort of my view on it all, if that makes sense.
Well, I'm still looking for a PS5 if anyone knows how to track one down. Fraser, let's bring you in though.
Did you enter the vaccine draw? You didn't win?
That was my
plan anyways for one.
I'm sure that was rigged. I'm joking.
Yeah. I agree with Justin. Like there is this pent up demand left over from, you know, the lockdowns and things like that. And that's bleeding into Now businesses are trying to fill that demand and they're trying to find workers to fill that demand. Like certain industries can ramp up relatively easily if they can find the bodies to do it. And it goes back to sort of what Justin was saying a little earlier around, you know, there's lots of postings, there's record postings, but then it's about, you know, how do you match people to those postings? And, you know, is that posting posted good enough, you know, the income good enough to incentivize someone to, you know, because they may still be, you know, working from home or doing something else, you know, are you actually able to move someone from one sector to another, or do they have the right skills? You know, we've heard, you know, we're in the midst of this great resorting, as they're sort of calling it a little bit in the US, where, you know, a lot of particularly young people are, you know, sort of leaving jobs and shifting careers right now because of COVID or in the post-COVID world. I don't know if that's a part of it here locally, where you think about someone who was a server, you know, has been laid off for more or less 2 years, but during that time, you know, maybe they started their own business doing whatever from home. And now, you know, they were able to build up a small following and they're able to sort of do that. And so now the bar or restaurant is short a server. And so it's not that necessarily people are just falling off the face of the earth or late, too lazy to work, but, you know, it's a question of, you know, where does, you know, the buck stop to a degree? And is there enough incentive to, you know, drive people to some of the jobs that are probably less easy, less fun, less enjoyable to do from a day-to-day sort of perspective in this sort of post-pandemic world where we've all been at home for almost 2 years?
Yeah, just to pick up on that, and Justin, I know you're short on time, but I did want to get this one in first. You mentioned a couple of spots where employers are posting jobs in record numbers, and you mentioned particularly engineering. What else does that landscape of demand look like? What jobs are in demand right now, and what jobs are unfilled?
Yeah, great. Another great question. This has been a great conversation, and I'll stay on a little bit longer if you're up for it, but a couple of things. One, Fraser's mentioned wages a couple of times, and I have this stat. I've never been able to use it, so I'm going to use it if you don't mind. Last month, of the 7,171 postings, 1,900 or so, 1,906 included something about a wage or a salary in the posting. Interestingly enough, about 7.7% of those postings were at minimum wage. So I wanted to sort of call that out. So it seems, you know, and there could be more, you know, some employers don't disclose this until you actually get to the interview stage, which I think is a real shame. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. In terms of, you know, what's going well in terms of sectors or occupations, I guess, by and large, you know, most sectors are up across the board. You know, manufacturing last month was 819 postings, and typically this will fluctuate between 300, 400, 500, 600. It's not normally as high as 800. And so I think that was a good sign. You're also seeing increases in healthcare and sort of the social services sector. They call it social assistance. It was up, you know, to 635 postings last month. Again, probably 150, 170 more than last month even, which was again high. The last 5 or 6 months, we've been higher on the posting side, but it was extremely high, like higher than it's ever been last month, of course. And even transportation warehousing, we've talked about this in terms of supply chain and the rest. But this is the time of the year that, you know, FedEx, UPS, Amazon, they all go out and hire and sort of bring in a lot of seasonal help to help with the parcels and in the holiday season. So, you know, we've seen increased, you know, postings out of this sector. So those things continue to happen. I guess in terms of occupations, the number one occupation in Ontario right now is material handler. You know, to John's point, hopefully that will make a PS5 suddenly appear sometime sooner. I have no idea, but material handler and retail salesperson are typically interchangeable between the top jobs. And that's sort of newer. I would say maybe pre-pandemic material handler was not quite as high. But this is the reality now in the world that we live in. that these are, and truck drivers remains high too. It's probably the top 10 in Ontario, but in Windsor last month, it was third highest with 172 postings. But for perspective, material handler was 210 and retail salesperson was 473 postings this past month. So that's just one occupation grouping, if that makes sense.
You wanted to jump in, Fraser?
Yeah, so Justin, I just actually had a follow-up question there. Of all of those postings, how many of those are recurring postings? Do you know that? Like, how many times is it the same company, you know, reposting the same job month after month versus, you know, a new position showing up there? I'm just curious if you know that.
Yeah, so when we collect our own job posting data, and we have like a deduplication process that actually tries to weed out some of that you describe. For example, when I quote 7,171 postings last month, that's postings that for at least one day in October were accepting applications. So they could have been posted the previous month and had, you know, part of the recruitment period enter into the month. But of the 7,100, 4,066 were brand new postings this past month. So there is some sort of spillover that happens where these postings do linger, but for the most part, we find, like right now, the average posting duration for this sort of data set that I'm looking at is 20.3 days. So postings stay open for about 3 weeks. And when those numbers go up, it means that employers are keeping them up longer, which may indicate that they're struggling to find the candidate that they would like.
Okay, Justin, in the piece, and I think John alluded to it already, Rakesh Naidu of the Chamber of Commerce mentioned the rising minimum wage and expressed that might be a concern. He's doing his job. He represents employers for the most part. But I wanted to ask you what your thoughts on how a rising minimum wage will affect the employment prospects for Windsorites and the material conditions of Windsorites as well.
Yeah, so, you know, first of all, doing a great job for the business community. I think this is what they need him to say and to come forward with that. And, you know, I'm partial to both sides of this debate. You know, there's this, you know, circular argument of, you know, if businesses can't afford to, you know, operate, then there's no jobs for workers. And if I'm also partial to the, you know, workers need to make a good amount of money, or there's, you know, there's no opportunity for them. And what's going to motivate them to stick around and stay in a job? To be honest, you know, businesses that sort of really thrive on minimum wage workers, you know, they have to get used to losing quality people. I think like they're going to struggle to retain high, you know, like quality talent, people who've got great potential. Hopefully they're good at picking that out of sort of a lineup and, you know, paying them more and giving them opportunities to grow and develop and maybe take on more experience or sort of more opportunity in the role. But at the end of the day, this is a job seeker's job market. We have, you know, 7,000 postings. I think income or like wages are sort of, there's upward pressure on them right now. And if you're not happy where you are, I think in today's market opportunity than there has been in the past couple of years to go and look around, find another employer.
Okay, Fraser, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I'd agree with almost everything that Justin said there. You know, Rakesh is doing a great job at the chamber, as he sort of said, and that's what you would sort of expect the Chamber of Commerce to say. And I think, you know, you could even argue that, you know, this was a surprise minimum wage increase. There was one back in October that I think was a you know, a 10 cent increase. And then this one was sort of a surprise increase announced by the government that'll come into place in January. So I think there's actually a legitimate grievance there from a business perspective, particularly if you have, you know, you're a smaller business that doesn't have the cash flow or things like that. I think materially for Windsorites, like this is a good thing, right? Like it is going to be a pay raise for a number of people in the community, and they're going to have more money in their pockets at a time when inflation is rising and prices for everything, not just houses, but also rent and food, and they're talking, you know, the cost of milk is supposed to go up in February by about 10% or something like that at the grocery store. That'll help people pay the bills. Like, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, are we going to see the, there has been a fair bit of research by, you know, seasoned economists from across the United States and Canada that have linked, you know, minimum wage increases do not markedly and measurably drive down employment or lead to mass layoff in most, you know, in most circumstances. There are some exceptions in highly specialized fields, but or highly, you know, niche fields. But, you know, so I'm not expecting, you know, as Justin sort of said, there is sort of a, if you're a worker and you're willing to work, it's a market where you can have a bit of choice right now. And so I think, to be honest, the minimum wage rising may actually help calm the market a little bit, because it'll probably bring up that floor ever so slightly. And certain people who maybe are just making that bare minimum wage will, you know, take that minimum wage hike as a reason to sort of stay where they are to a degree. But I would point out that Windsor Essex's living wage is $15.85, which is still 85 cents an hour more than what the minimum wage is. So you still can't, you know, pay all your bills, pay all your rent, you know, put some money away from your kids, do some activities in the community, pay for childcare and all those things on the new minimum wage. So, you know, that's still a challenge for a lot of people in our community.
Yeah, I think, you know, employers who were used to paying, you know, $14.35 an hour more recently, although it was $14.25 not that long ago. And for employers who pay, you know, workers, you know, $15, $16, $17, $18 an hour, this is putting a lot of pressure on them. They have other considerations beyond just the people that went from 14 to 15. They have a group of employees who were potentially making $15 or $16 or $17 an hour and now saying, like, okay, so if I could go down the street, you know, what good is the experience I've already had here and put in here? And what's that worth to my employer now? So it does put upward pressure on not just minimum wage earners, but also other lower wage earners in our community. There are some pros and cons to this. You know, there's no easy answer other than, you know, businesses have to, you know, sort of continue to do well. You know, they have to improve customer service. They have to have better sales. They need to do a better job at retaining employees and like fighting for margins, you know. But if you're a business that is profiting on low wage workers and that's basically 99% of like your staff, like you're going to be in a tougher market now because of it, for sure.
You know, I wonder how it's going. Well, I mean, you know how it's going to affect, but the hospitality industry with the server wage jumping up from what, $12.35 up to that 15 as well, that's going to be a huge hit. I remember when I had higher limits, when it went from 11 to 14, we were paying 12. So we went 12 to 15, but that $3 an hour, that was a significant increase. So I think that you're going to see some of the hospitality folks really, you know, pushing back in whatever way that they can, probably most likely just vocally, but they need the workers, you know. But there is an election coming up. I'm sure that there's some politics at play here. And I wanted to shift the conversation a little bit into the politics. And Doug, I wanted to pose this one to you first, to be honest. I was speaking with Councillor Borland about this issue a while ago, and wanted to get his perspective. And, you know, he's always emphasized the point that he doesn't think that it should be a city's focus overly to be focusing on jobs directly themselves, rather, you know, creating the conditions that can help bring it about. But he was saying, if this is the reality that we're in right now, one, but two, we've decided to take on the role of economic development and diversification with the Windsor Works report, what role is there in this context then to be doing something about these numbers? I mean, you know, the numbers are still, they're not the greatest. We're still worse in, you know, all the ways that aren't great when compared provincially or nationally. So the question that he was bringing up, I want to pose it to you is, you know, is this the time, rather than, you know, having symposiums and bringing people together to keep talking about things, should there be some kind of a bringing together of, you know, LiUNA, for example, and the college to figure out, can we put together a one-year training program to rapidly get people into the workforce? What is that level of involvement that should be taken here if we've actually decided to, you know, supposedly do this through Windsor Works?
That's the question for me.
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, I think it is a really interesting philosophical question. I guess the job of a city is to do what the residents need it to do. I'm not so sure that jurisdictional arguments are the best way for politicians and other people in positions of responsibility to decide what they should or should not be doing. You know, we've talked throughout this wonderful conversation, we've talked about some of the persistent challenges that Windsor faces. And I don't think it's something that there's not a button in the mayor's office or in city council chambers that is the, you know, unleash more good paying jobs button. It's just not that easy. And I don't think that the government at any level can go it alone and solve employment problems. It takes industry. It takes education. You know, there are a lot of factors at play and there are a lot of players who have something to contribute. I've sat around a few of these tables in my time. Justin has been around some of those tables as well. And, you know, I'm not running for anything and I don't represent anyone except for myself. So I think that it's, you know, I'm in a position where I can say, I think what I would like to see based only on my own experience is more genuine engagement by institutions and government and employers, more genuine engagement to create collective solutions. We pay a lot of lip service to this. And I think it's relatively easy and it's good to be talking about it in general. But these are not problems that can be solved from City Hall. They're problems that City Hall can influence. They're challenges that City Hall can have a positive influence on. And to the extent that Councillor Borland was saying that, you know, it's not a city's job and something like Windsor Works is not something that the city should be doing, I would disagree. I think that the convening power of municipal government being put to use to bring people together to work on these problems is very good. I think the conversation should be broadened out. I would like to see more folks around the table. I'd like to see conversation get wider. And you know, you mentioned LIUNA, our sponsor, but also a labor union. And I think trying to forge a path to a more constructive conversation between management and labor is something that I've been waiting a long time to see happen in our community. And I haven't seen it happen, but I think that's something that would be a great place to start in terms of making lasting change. And just to stay on that, organized labor in general is mostly absent from the Windsor Works report. And I have noticed that it has been mostly absent, at least in my view and to what I've seen in the conversations around it. And I think that's got to change. But I don't think it's simply a matter of organized labor not being invited and not being given a seat at the table. I also think that that we have to start to have more constructive conversations and less knee-jerk conversations and really think about what a collective solution looks like. That's my answer.
Justin, Fraser, either of you want to jump in on anything that Doug said or, you know, the topic overall?
For me, I guess, you know, not to be at the risk of making this sound cute, I will say, you know, the path to getting 7,000 new jobs is one person at a time. You know, like the joblessness situation for people is an individual problem. It's a problem that they need supports and helps and coaching and encouragement, you know, and that doesn't just stop the day they get, you know, walk into day one and sort of a new employment opportunity. It needs to continue for, you know, 30, 60, 90, 180 days while they get settled and into a new work routine. You know, right now in Windsor, according to StatsCan, it's estimated that 17,100 people are jobless. And so the supports that you need for those people are as unique as the people, as you would imagine those people are. And so it's hard for, I agree with Doug, there's no button that you can push to fix all of this. You have to chip away at it. And some of the best opportunities for employment are in some of the most regulated or sort of really difficult occupations to get into. Apprenticeships, for example, and skilled trades. All of us have tried to build something, hire someone, get a contractor in. And you know what? The prices are going up and it's hard to get done. And, you know, sometimes the work when you get it is sort of rushed or sloppy and maybe not up to the standard you had hoped when you had purchased the big renovation. But at the end of the day, like, there's a bit of an on-ramp to get somebody who's not in the labor market to a position where they could enter a skilled trade or an occupation like that. And unfortunately, when unions and even contractors are in the market looking to hire someone, they're looking for someone who's job ready. And they're not necessarily looking to hire someone to ramp up and give them a whole lot of sort of room to sort of learn as they go and, you know, acquire these skills at their pace. So I think the role of government and some of the others is to create space for this on-ramp to allow people to sort of, you know, transition from unemployment to employment. But you need employers in this equation because you need to know when, what the demand is and when it's expected to hit. And you need to have a sense of timing. And I think, you know, one issue I hear from unions all the time is they don't necessarily know when the next big project is coming. You know, they don't know when their next contract is, and they're 100% focused on their current membership because they have elections and they have their own processes. So they want to make sure every single member in their hall is working before they go out and hire new people. And so there is this, you know, chasing your tail effect of, I'm not going to hire someone until I need someone. But then when I need someone, I need them now. But the problem is that the people who are jobless are not ready now. And so, like, how do you begin to smooth out that path is sort of the big question. I know, you know, that was a big focus of all the work that Fraser had done at United Way and elsewhere. So I'd love to maybe get his opinion on some of this too.
Yeah. So I think government, particularly municipal governments, can have a massive role in this. And I think I think one of the things that I take away from the chart that's behind me is that the absence of some real structural leadership in this space from the municipal government table, even in a targeted way, has helped create some of the structural challenges that Justin was just sort of talking about. He's absolutely right. You need to build these on-ramps. And the problem is those ramps take time to build. They take space to build. They take relationships to build. And that takes time. So it doesn't help us now. It doesn't help us for next April when 1,200 people are going to get laid off. You know, I think, you know, municipalities could start simple. We saw a community benefit agreement on the Gordie Howe Bridge, you know, that was going to hire people, ensure that they were going to get trained for good paying jobs. You know, on the U.S. side, that meant like government funded training programs to take veterans and visible minority Black Latino populations and train them for jobs to help build the bridge. You know, there is no reason why the city's capital budget couldn't be set up to actually do the same thing. You're gonna invest a couple $100 million a year in roads and sewers. So why aren't you taking 10 or 20 people now, training them as a cohort, and their internship placement apprenticeship hours are just gonna be on all city job sites next year. And as a condition of bidding in those RFPs, you require your bidders to hire your trainees. Like, you can do those buy local things with city dollars. You know, for every dollar that circulates, I read a stat, every dollar, municipal dollar that stays in the community, it circulates six times compared to like a dollar that like goes to like a general multinational or something like that. So, you know, there's things like in Toronto, they have an organization called Anchor TO, and this is a partnership between the city of Toronto, the school boards, and like three of the universities, and they've combined their purchasing power and they've directed that purchasing power under certain levels to local small business. So like, if you're a flower shop down the street, you can get a contract for under $5,000 from the city of Toronto, and administration is tasked and told they have to go to that sort of preferred contract, small business contractor list first before they do like an RFP sort of thing. You can invest the city. Now the city's already doing this. Municipalities are already doing this. There's already a joint partnership agreement around some of, you know, the school boards, I think, collaborate on their purchasing, things like that. but there is no visible line of sight. No, I think the lack of transparency around what is and isn't happening creates opportunities where if we better understood what's already happening, you could then micro-target, you know, certain things to solve some of those problems. A last example is like a couple of years ago, I read a story, this town of Stratford, you know, they partnered with their local high school. They, you know, as a small, you know, medium-sized town, they're having trouble as a municipality hiring carpenters. So they actually funded a carpentry program at the Stratford High School to build all the park benches and picnic tables. And it was built in the shop class. And then they, you know, they gave an incentive to the students. It was an after school sort of bonus credit program, but then it exposed those young people. And I'm sure the town of Stratford then probably hired some of those students to, you know, paint fences and do stuff like that in the summer job. So it gave them their first work experience. It gave them experience in a field. That's a long-term pipeline for the town of Stratford. They're working with, you know, 15-year-olds, but, you know, like it, doing little things like that, you know, then over the long term, like the chart behind you, behind me, allows you to start bending those curves and changing those norms.
Man, having a city list of municipally approved purchases before going out, I mean, could you do that with consultants too?
Do it with whatever you want.
So jokes aside, Justin, we'll let you go. We asked for you for, you know, a very short period of time, 20 minutes, and you've spent double that with us so far. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Enjoy the conversation. Great to see you, everyone on the event or on the show with everyone. So take care and all the best. And if you can hold off on that vacation, we'll get the prices a little bit lower.
Don't hold off on getting me a PS5, anyone, though. If you have the opportunity, do it.
Hey, whatever it costs, get it for John.
Yeah, I just realized, no, don't do that. It's going to come back and bite me in the ass. Thank you, though, Justin. Really appreciate your perspective and insight there.
Yeah.
Cheers. Well, let's leave that as a good point there. We've got a couple other topics to get to, but I think this is a good one to flow straight into. 2022 budget will be mindful of ongoing local pandemic pressures. AM800's Aaron Mahoney put this out. 2022 budget deliberations are approaching, and Mayor Dilkins told AM800 that pandemic pressures will be presenting themselves in the budget, especially regarding transit Windsor, with operating only at 50% operations. Now, the mayor emphasized that he was, quote, sensitive to the 1,100 out-of-work Caesars employees and the second shift Stellantis employees who will soon to be losing their jobs, and what he dubbed, quote, huge inflationary pressures that people are seeing at grocery stores. And so he said that this budget will be presented in a way that will reflect our sensitivity while also meeting the objective he set at the beginning of his term. Now, City Council in July directed administration to cut 10% and to implement a tax freeze. That was against administration's recommendation of an inflationary tax increase and 5% cuts. You know, so it's sounding a little bit here, we're getting back into the austerity phase of how things were done for a pretty long time. Doug, you know, the thing that popped into my mind first with this, I was going through our notes, and it was June earlier of this year when the new CAO, Jason Raynor, you know, he made his first report and we went through it. We were all pretty impressed with what he brought forward, but it was in his SWOT analysis where he actually proposed, you know, multi-year tax increases. Here we are, though. City Council gave marching orders to administration to, you know, disregard what the new CAO was looking for here. Let's go back to the way things were. I don't think that should be surprising going into an election year right now, combined with the fact that we're in a pandemic. But what's your take about this one, Doug? You know, you were the one who shared this article first with me.
Yeah. So I find it interesting. Now, let's keep in mind, this was one interview on AM800. So I don't know. We'll see what the numbers actually look like when the budget hits. I'm glad you reminded us about the the directive to administration in July to continue providing or asking departments for a 10% budget cut. That's a good reminder. I tend to see this as political. On the show last week, we talked a little bit about changing political dynamics. And I think that Mayor Dilkins has gotten some pretty strong signals from the quote unquote fiscal hawks on council that where they're going to land on things. And I suspect that if Mayor Dilkins needs their votes to get a budget passed, he may have to start moving in this direction in order to do that. That's the politics of it. Quite interesting, in my opinion, and something to watch and see how that rhetoric evolves. On the substance, though, the only tool to respond to any circumstance is austerity. So there are actually a wide range of tools available to the municipality, particularly fiscal tools. I noted in the piece that Mayor Dilkins mentioned that transit ridership is down 50% as one of the pressures that is on the municipality. The municipality has a lot of options in terms of how it chooses to raise money and how it chooses to spend money. One of the things that the municipality could consider is whether or not there should be a return to debt financing for some capital projects. That's an option that's available to them that they have not taken. The municipality chooses to pursue pay-as-you-go and continues to pursue that. So I only bring that up to mention that there are options beyond, finding ways to chip away at the cost of doing business at City Hall. There are options available beyond that to respond to the pressures that are brought by the pandemic. And I think you could make an equally strong argument that clamping down at a time when there's already significant uncertainty and where there are already issues in terms of we had a discussion just a minute ago about how much difficulty there has been keeping two shifts employed at Windsor Assembly, and that's going to continue. So is the only and correct answer to to go back to the days of tax freezes? I really am not sure that's the case. And I think, whenever this comes up and whenever that line of rhetoric is pursued, I think it's really important to point out that the people who depend most on municipal services will benefit far beyond the amount that's on their tax bill or what is passed through to them from their landlord. If you're a person, for example, who relies on transit to get around, cuts to transit service would be a far bigger negative impact on you than a 3-5% tax hike would have on you. And I think that's true for many things that the city does to provide us with an equitable place to live.
That's such a good point. I just wanted to echo that before bringing you in, Fraser. If you're concerned about these people who are already out of work, who are going to be losing their jobs, what the spinoff is going to be from that, you're not going to be able to cut your way out of that problem. And, they're the ones who are going to need transit. They're the ones who are going to need these community services. They're the ones who might need to be going to the library to be doing these job searches, to be using computers. They might be the ones who need outreach workers. So it's just, we've seen what happens from these successive cuts. And it led us to a point where we were supposed to see this complete new restructuring to move us out of it. And it's frustrating to, right before an election campaign, see us just jumping on the carousel again, hoping that we'll grab that brass ring that will, I guess, push the jobs button and the money button on the printer. Fraser, though?
Yeah, so I think we have to remember, that 10% cut in tax freeze has been, yes, it's been sort of the starting point for budgets, but the last several budgets started there and still had increases. So, I think, and if I recall, it was a 6-5 vote, I believe, to get to that, to even have administration go there. So there is a group around council who aren't necessarily like, okay, I think they're not looking for, a freeze automatically, I think. And you have to remember, a large portion of the city budget is already sort of actioned in that multi-year capital budget. They've already made numbers of commitments. So like we know, we can go look at last year's budget. We have a good idea of what capital projects are going to get done. They're going to do $1 million in parks next year. They're going to do X, Y, and Z. And yes, they can move some of those dollars around, but like for the most part, it's sort of locked in. I also think, you know, obviously there was the new budget tool that you guys talked about a few weeks ago. It'll be interesting to see where that lands, right? So that survey, I think, comes down like this Friday, the online budgeting tool. And if people come in and say, you know, yeah, you know, I want you to spend 10% more on Transit Windsor. I want you to spend 10% more on social services. Like that's going to be a different narrative and there's going to be a different sort of perception put forward. Now, the opposite could hold true. People could be like, cut everything. And, you know, that could be, you know, again, it depends on how informed and how engaged the users of that tool were beyond just like, what does it mean for the tax increase year in, year out? So I think it's going to be interesting to watch. It doesn't really surprise me. I also think that there's a lot of pressure to spend in this budget just because it is the election budget. There won't be another budget until after the election. And so, you know, whatever issues and gets moved forward or moved up in this budget will be the things that are on literature, you know, next summer and fall when people are at the door.
You know, it's just, it's going to be so funny when you see this debate really, you know, get earnest or, you know, faux earnest with, you know, some of the people that are on council with the monikers and the marketing that they like to wrap themselves up in. But it'll be hard to defend, you know, these types of cuts amid, you know, we've said this before recently, but, you know, 80 Knox, we're just going to be spending blindly up to $35 million, regardless of whether or not we get funding from the province or the feds for it.
No, I actually want to be clear on that. The mayor was clear. If they don't get the funding, they'll reassess the project. And so, and he said that elements could be removed from the project if the federal government does not provide the funding. So in other words, what would happen is 80 Knox is likely to be redeveloped. It's just redeveloped into what? And that is, the what is contingent on the federal funding. And so, you know, you could see, for example, like the splash pad is going in next year. Like that is in the budget now already. It's been sort of locked in. So it's really about what. And in theory, you know, the price tag, I think the bigger challenge with the 80 Knox number is that $30 million number is floated out there. And what might actually materialize if the federal government doesn't come through is a $5 million or a $7 million community facility when something much bigger and grander was promised to a West End community that has seen significant divestment of city services.
Yeah, no, then, I mean, there's no doubt about that. Then from that perspective, either way, you know, it's still a situation where if we're looking at these massive cuts here that are supposedly going to be coming, and who knows if it's going to be, you know, we're going to see the 10% cuts actually implemented across the board or whatever. But my point being is, you know, it's hard to defend, you know, the streetcar housing as a priority, you know, Festival Plaza as a priority, this as a priority amidst cuts in this environment as people are losing these jobs. You know, it's all politics at the end of the day. But let's leave the show there. We're going to cut the last two topics that we had because as these great conversations do sometimes go a bit longer, but we don't want to forget for your consideration. And if I could go first here, Doug, because I want Fraser to be able to comment a little bit about this one, you know, switching up how we do it. Fraser, I'm stealing from you for the four-year consideration. You put out a tweet a couple days ago talking about how London does their budget and they've got a strategic priorities and policy committee, which does a first review. They invite in key agencies and stakeholders that are able to do a Q&A with, you know, with city council, with administration, get the facts they want. It sounds entirely foreign and abstract to me. How could you possibly do something like that? Because here in Windsor, as you made clear, you know, we see the mayor do a budget drop typically on a Thursday afternoon or a Friday morning, getting the Saturday story, and no one has any knowledge that it's coming. And then we've got what, a couple weeks to deal with what's been presented, and then, you know, it goes. So I guess, you know, in a weird for your consideration, Fraser, what's your consideration about how it should be done for the listeners?
Yeah, I think, you know, so to tease my other podcast, I have Megan Stacey on, and she is the only City Hall reporter in Southwestern Ontario. She works for the London Free Press. And so we talk a lot about what's going on in London City Hall this Thursday on Council Conversations. But yeah, she, you know, one of the things that I think I'm really struggling with right now is, you know, the advantages that I've had is I've had a lot of conversations with through this other podcast with other communities, and it shows like how different things can be done and what are the different ways that things can be done. And I think, you know, having a structured process for how your budget will roll out every year. So it's 30 days before the actual budget deliberation, this committee convenes, it's all of council. They bring in economic development, health unit, their tech alliance was came in. They talked about, you know, who anyone receiving funding as an agency is requested to come in. They aren't allowed to, there's no debate. There's only technical questions allowed to be asked. And then there's recommendations from administration on, okay, so they know they're going to spend $1.08 billion next year. There's 12 options to tweak that number presented by administration. And I believe, and I'm just checking right now, and they're projecting a 2.8% property tax increase. So mayor, council all heard the same information, more or less all at the same time. They can now spend the next month talking to their constituents. And then, you know, on December 2nd, everyone will get back in the room and they'll hash out sort of the 12 potential changes that could, that are recommended or not.
Man, that sounds so useful from like the nerd perspective. It sounds like it'd be a pretty interesting day to just, you know, get a bunch of that data out there. Most of all, I mean, it doesn't sound like theater. It sounds like that would be an actual engaging day where the community has a role to play as a delegate rather than just, you know, say your 5 minutes and get out the back door and don't let anyone see you leave, please.
Certainly that there's a bad opportunity. I think the challenge is that month between when the information comes out and when the information actually budget deliberation, that becomes the time of political, you know, it becomes a broader political theater. It sort of stretches out the drama a little bit. And particularly if there's a highly contentious budget, the other thing that London does is it does multi-year budgeting. So what's in the budget isn't actually a surprise. They set this budget 4 years ago. So they already know the bulk of what most of the sort of core funding priorities were from the start of term when they did their strategic planning process back in 2018.
Wait, why would you plan things out 4 years in advance when you can just sort of do it ad hoc as you go?
Right. It's a good question. I don't know.
Okay. Well, 4 year consideration, I guess we could do things better here. Doug, what's up next?
A Rose City Politics listener brought this to my attention and I'm still digesting it, but I think it's really interesting. So I wanted to share it with everyone. I will put the link on the Rose City Politics Twitter. But what I'm looking at is the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, has been doing a multi-year project on innovative citizen participation. They have on this website, they have videos, they have multiple reports going into detail on case studies about ways to engage citizens and get more digital citizen engagement in community affairs. So I thought it might be of interest to our listeners. It's certainly of interest to me. I will read out the URL. I think that kind of is something we stopped doing in about 1997, but I'm kind of living in 1997, so I'm going to do it anyway. www.oecd.org/gov/innovative-citizen-participation.htm. I do like the use of the .htm suffix. You don't see that very often anymore. So kudos to OECD for kicking it 90s style on their website. Anyway, check it out. I'm diving in myself. I hope that lots of our listeners dive into these reports and find all the good stuff, and we'll talk about it in the weeks and months to come for your consideration.
Sounds very interesting. You got anything you want to bring up, Fraser, or are you done with us tonight?
Sure. So for your consideration, I actually planned ahead because I knew this might happen. Yes. So last week on my podcast, so I'm going to plug my podcast again, though.
Whoa.
Oh man.
I'm only allowed one plug per show.
I'm a guest. last week I had Dave Cassidy on my podcast. He's the head of Unifor 444. And he came on, we recorded that podcast less than a week after the news broke that Stellantis was going to be laying off another 1,200 workers here in Windsor. Frankly, I'm super thankful he came on even. I was fully expecting him to sort of, hey, the world's on fire. I got to cancel. We'll do it again in the future. But one of the interests, he took the time to actually explain all the stuff that's going on behind the scenes within the union to try and, you know, figure out how to save some of those jobs. But one of the conversations we got to was the need for a potential just transition plan for auto workers in this community. And that we've seen, you know, over decades now, tens of thousands of auto workers being laid off in this community in a variety of ways at a variety of points in time. And for those that aren't aware, a just transition strategy is often linked, you know, to sunset industries or industries facing challenges around, you know, so you're hearing it a lot around oil and gas right now, but also natural resource industries. And so starting to think about how do we take those 1,200 workers and transfer them into other sectors, retrain them for other sectors so that they can then get a good paying job in this community and link that to employment in our community. And so I started snooping around to see, because that was the first time I've really heard anyone in the public realm, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, talk about that for our community in sort of a public way. And that caught my interest. And so I started looking around. And there's actually an application as a part of the Windsor Works implementation plan that you guys talked about a couple of weeks ago around an application that they want to submit to the Future Skills Center, which is a government funding or arm's length government funding nonprofit, which is really around, you know, determining how you transition and build up skills for people across a wide range of sectors. And so it'd be a partnership here locally looking to get some funding to determine how you would transition auto workers to careers in generally tech and cybersecurity and automobility. I think it's certainly an interesting proposal. There are some challenges, the biggest one of which is that the Future Skills Center has already funded auto transition work in Oshawa and in Kitchener-Waterloo. And so the concern that I would have is if this is our only plan, if this is our only shot to start thinking about how to transition auto workers into other careers in an effective and efficient way, we have to have a plan B. It can't be just this. And I think the concern that I have is that the Future Skills Center has already invested almost $1 million into auto worker transitions in Ontario. They've invested several million dollars into oil and gas, fisheries, and mining transition strategies in other communities and other regions in Canada. And so they're getting a ton of information on how to transition workers into new careers. And so one of the things that we have to start thinking about is really how do we accelerate these conversations? And this goes back to what Doug was saying earlier. You know, the chart behind me is a 5-year chart or more, actually, of sort of the long-term struggles of our community. And if we don't start thinking now about how we solve some of these big problems, we're not going to get there in a timely manner. And so I think if we're expecting other levels of government or other pots of funding to actually solve our problems for us, I think we're setting ourselves up for fail. So I think we have to really think about what and how we're doing things as we move forward.
Okay, I know it's bad form, but to comment on someone else's for your consideration, but I'm just gonna jump in here. Fraser, I wasn't aware of that particular detail in the Windsor Works implementation report. And I have to say, like, I've seen a lot of horseshit in this town, but this is something that's incredibly serious. It's super important that we figure out a way to transition folks who are dependent on the auto industry to fund their family, help them transition into meaningful and remunerative work in the future. And to take a bag of buzzwords, stick your hand in, pull out three and throw them into an application is a big pile of horseshit that does a huge disservice to the very real and pressing needs of people in our community. Sorry, I know that was bad form. I'll leave it at that.
Doug, Doug's words, not mine.
No one's going to mistake that. He says them every week. Jokes aside, hey, Fraser, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Really appreciate it. Really appreciate you coming with a four-year consideration as well, and you know, letting me steal that one from your Twitter feed as well. Thanks for sharing.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. It is November the 10th, and this is Rose City Politics. Your regular panel tonight included myself, John Libke, Doug Sartori. We had guest panelist researcher Fraser Fathers, as well as Justin Falconer, CEO of Workforce Windsor Essex, who joined us for the first half of the show. Doug, you said that people don't announce URLs. I do it every episode at the beginning and at the end for our favorite friends, our Patreon subscribers. And if you're not, make sure you head over to patreon.com/RoseCityPolitics. We are in BizX Magazine and at bizxmagazine.com on all of your favorite social media and podcasting apps. And as always, Rose City Politics is able to broadcast live on tape thanks to the kind support of Liuna 625 Building Better Communities. We will be back in 1 week.